You may be seated. Ooh, spirits in this place. You feel that? Isn't that the best? Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Unity Renaissance on this fine and beautiful Sunday morning. It's great to have you all here for a very special celebration today with a guest speaker I'll talk about in just a few moments. We have been at, Richard and I and a few others, Alan Page and Donna and a few others have been back at Unity Convention in Albuquerque, just got back last night, some of us very late last night, and two things stood out for me as I was at the National Unity Convention. The first was how much I love our Unity movement, how much hope it gives me for our world, for all the ways in which our beliefs in oneness and inclusivity and honoring all paths, how much that makes a difference in people's lives, and how much more good there is for us to do in the world. So just a great renewal of hope and inspiration around what unity is. And the second thing I must tell you, when I get with other ministers and others who are in unity, that strikes me so strongly is how very much I love this church. I really love this church and all of you. And as soon as I start... Thank you. As soon as I begin talking about it, I begin to gush. And luckily, people are very patient with me about that. But we have something very special here, and it's your spirit and your consciousness that makes it so. So I'm just grateful to each and every one of you, and I'm ecstatic to be back with you today. So as you know, in Unity, we honor all names for God, all paths to God, all expressions of God. And hopefully as you come through those doors and enjoy this service today, you have that great sense of feeling accepted and loved for exactly who you are, wherever your path has taken you and wherever it leads you from here. At Unity Renaissance, we hold the vision for, together, a spiritually awakened world, living in peace, love, and joy. And we pursue that vision through our mission, which is, together, we transform lives that transform the world. And as we know, transformation is an inside job. So let's begin our transformation work today in prayer. I invite you to take a deep breath in, close your eyes if that's comfortable for you. And just breathe in deeply the joy and the blessings of this new day. And as you exhale, let go of any random thoughts, any concerns, anything that might be distracting you from this now moment. Truly, we come together today in this spirit of oneness, of joy, of open-heartedness. We feel our connection with one another and indeed with all of life. What a blessing it is to come together each Sunday and remember this great truth of who we are individually and collectively. In this very moment, we feel our oneness with God, Spirit, whatever you choose to call it. We feel our oneness with something much greater than ourselves, and we feel a sense of oneness with each other. This is the truth. And this is the truth that sets us free. So we celebrate this time together, this remembering of all of the beautiful gifts that we've been given, of our innate divinity, even in our humanity, celebrating it all and sending it forth for the glory of God. Thank you for the blessings of this day. Thank you for this life. And so it is. Amen.
Thank you for that beautiful song. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today. Beautiful day outside, somewhat humid, but nevertheless, I'm glad the sun is shining. I was asked here today to talk about Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Transcendentalist movement that he spearheaded. And the best way I know how to do that is to talk about my personal relationship with him, if you will. Obviously, we didn't know each other. He was born in 1803. But I feel that I know him. I feel that his writing expresses my thoughts and feelings in a way that at the time I discovered him, at any rate, I couldn't I couldn't do myself. But before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about my upbringing, because it's relevant to, of course, all, in every case, with every individual, it's relevant to how our minds and hearts are shaped. I was born in Staten Island, as Paula said, and coincidentally, Emerson's brother lived there for a long time, and there is even a hill named after him called Emerson Hill. What's more, Henry David Thoreau, who, as you know, if you know anything about the Transcendentalists, Thoreau was Emerson's protege, and Thoreau lived there with Emerson's brother for about a year and actually wrote about Staten Island in interesting ways. Staten Island those days must have been pretty extraordinary, because even when I was born, it was filled with woods, and I spent a lot of time in those woods playing with my friends, you know, catching frogs and snakes and climbing trees and that sort of thing. Kind of an odd thing to be doing in a borough of New York City, but there you have it. I had kind of the best of both worlds in terms of proximity to Manhattan, but also that traditional kind of American childhood, Huckleberry Finn, if you will. The woods were crucially important to Emerson as well, the study of nature. Emerson wrote, "In the woods, a man cast off his years and is always a child." And to this day, when I hike, as I do frequently in the Blue Ridge Mountains, or go horseback riding or what have you, I feel that childhood spirit reemerge, which is crucially important. All the world religions remind us that, you know, as Jesus said, you must be as children, by which he means be open to new experiences. That really is the heart of Emerson's writings. My religious upbringing was somewhat different from Emerson's. I was, from the time I was 3 years old, I attended a very historic Episcopal church in Staten Island called St. Andrew's, and it dated back to 1708. So a lot of history there. And I love that that liturgy, even before I could understand why. I love the hymns and the poetic language of the Book of Common Prayer, taking communion, you know, the gleam of the chalice and the taste of the wine, which was, of course, drinking wine when you were, you know, nine was particularly exciting. You know, after a while, as I progressed through adolescence, late adolescence, I would say, I started to intellectually question the church. I never got that fire and brimstone feeling from the Episcopal Church, but you know, the creed itself intellectually began to clash with my emerging intellectual beliefs, particularly the notion that Jesus is the only Son of God, which offended my sensibilities because it felt that it was, by definition, denigrating other religions. I didn't feel that that was necessarily something God would would endorse. So I went off to college open, searching, and didn't really know where I was headed, either intellectually or spiritually, but discovering Emerson in a freshman year class, literature class, really helped crystallize my own thinking. The first thing that caught my attention was not something from one of his great lectures or essays, but something from his journal. He said that the truth is self-evident. It is light. You don't get a candle to see the sunrise. That last phrase particularly stuck with me. And the way I interpret that is Emerson was saying, we don't need an intermediary of any kind to know God. Just as you don't need to take a candle to the window to see the sunrise. No intermediary. You don't need a church. You don't need the Bible. You don't need a preacher. We can know God because God is within all of us. So Emerson, of course, hadn't always felt that way. Far from it. He was descended from, you know, Puritans, essentially, and a long line of ministers in his family, his father, his grandfather, great-grandfather. So it was natural back in those days. Somebody who wanted to live a life of the mind had fewer options than they do today. And so the ministry was a way of making a living through study and writing and speaking. So he went off to Harvard, then subsequently to Harvard Divinity School. But a series of personal crises rocked his belief in Orthodox Christianity and religion generally, among them the death of his young wife, just 18 months after they were married. So in 1832, he resigned from the church, went off to Europe to clear his head. And when he came back in 1834, he settled in Concord, Massachusetts, which is today is essentially a suburb of Boston. It was a small town, needless to say, back then, but with great history, as you know, if you know your American Revolution history. But a key moment, so he began his career writing and lecturing. He was a freelancer, basically. Lecturing back then was a way of making a living, freelance lecturing, because a lot of people would attend lectures in the absence of anything else to do, like go to the movies or the things we enjoy today, right? In 1838, he was invited to speak to the graduating class of Harvard Divinity School, his alma mater. And little did the leaders of the school know that he was about to rock their world in ways they didn't particularly care for. The address, it's really it boils down to my favorite piece of writing by Emerson. The address doesn't start out in a particularly revolutionary way, but it begins with a great line. In this refulgent summer, it has been a luxury to draw the breath of life. Now, Emerson, of course, was very attuned to nature. So on the one hand, you could take that as at face value. It's a luxury to be outside breathing the fresh air. But there's a lot more to it than that. In fact, I think his central theological point is in that phrase, the breath of life. Because after all, in Genesis, we are told that God breathed into Adam the breath of life, by which he didn't mean just the ability to intake oxygen, but the spirit, his spirit. So Emerson goes on, and it starts to get a little more controversial. Key passage for me is this. Jesus belonged to the true race of prophets. Alarm bells right there, right? Because he's in suggesting that Jesus was, as Muslims believe, for instance, that Jesus was a prophet, like Moses and many others. And this, of course, flew in the face of what even the Unitarians, Emerson was a Unitarian, what they believed. It's important to recognize that the Unitarian Church back then was very different from what it is today. It was very liberal by those standards, but very conservative by our standards. For example, they still celebrated the Eucharist. This was a sticking point for Emerson. He didn't believe that those rituals were necessary and also felt that they somehow distorted the teachings of Jesus. Emerson goes on to say, the idioms of Jesus' language and the figures of his rhetoric have usurped the place of his truth. Christianity became a mythos, as the poetic teaching of Greece and Egypt before. He spoke of miracles, for he knew that man's life was a miracle, and he knew that the daily miracle shines as the character ascends. But the word miracle, as pronounced by Christian churches, gives a false impression. It is a monster. It is not one with the blowing clover and the falling rain. That didn't go over too well, as you might imagine. Went over, I imagine, with the students who had the students were the ones who had invited him. It was a very small group, by the way. There were only 12 graduates. And I've had the good fortune to visit the chapel, which is still there. Tiny room. It's about the size of your average classroom in a school. But as an aside, that's a good thing to keep in mind. You think if you're speaking to 12 people and their families, how much of an impact could you have? Well, as we all know, if we've ever dropped a pebble in a pond and seen it ripple out, an address to 12 people can have a huge impact. And this did. It did on Emerson's personal life because the Harvard did not invite him back to speak for about 20 years. He closes the address by urging these graduates, the future clergymen, to, quote, go alone, refuse the good models, even those which are sacred in the imagination of men, and dare to love God without mediator or veil. Another important text for me during this college class when I was discovering Emerson was his first book called Nature. And in it, he describes a spiritual experience that would later come to me or something very similar firsthand. He writes, crossing a bare common in snow puddles at twilight under a clouded sky, without having in my thoughts any occurrence of special good fortune, I have enjoyed a perfect exhilaration. I am glad to the brink of fear. What strikes me about that, in addition to that really intriguing phrase, glad to the brink of fear, is the ordinariness of this setting. We've all had the experience, I think, of being awed in the presence of nature's beauty. A sunset from the summit of a mountain or a waterfall, the stars at night, what have you. But this had none of that going on. It was gray. There were just patches of snow, presumably somewhat dirty, as snow tends to get as it melts away and gets stepped on. Nothing extraordinary at all, even perhaps somewhat gloomy. And yet, Emerson felt that in those settings, even if we're open to spirit or whatever you want to call it, we can be overcome by it. Well, like Emerson, who was a great walker, like Thoreau as well, and as an aside, one of Thoreau's lesser-known writings that I urge you to read is simply called Walking. It's an essay on walking. Emerson and Thoreau used to take walks a lot together. And I like to do that as well, alone. I like to do it, though, in Manhattan very often, where you achieve kind of a public solitude, right? You're alone, even though you're surrounded by millions of people. Well, on one particular Sunday, I was walking through Central Park with no particular destination in mind, which is the best way to walk, I believe. And I wasn't surrounded by anyone. There was no one as far as the eye could see. It was January. It was very, very similar to this setting that Emerson describes, patches of snow. Had no particular thoughts in my mind of anything, negative or positive. And suddenly I was overcome with a sense of connection to something, a presence, nobody around. Something I couldn't define, but I truly was glad to the brink of fear. And I wasn't thinking of Emerson. It just happened. It just happened. So after that, my spiritual journey took me pretty far and wide. I began to particularly study Buddhism and go to the Zen Center of New York and meditate, where I recall the leader of the workshop retreat saying that there were Catholic priests and nuns who went there regularly to practice Zazen, which is sitting meditation in Zen. And that really stayed with me, this notion of ecumenicism, right? This notion that even a Catholic priest was open to the idea that there is something to gain from another spiritual practice. Still, that old attachment to the church, the Anglican church in particular, but churches in general, the buildings themselves stayed with me. And I would often, on these walks in Manhattan, when I wasn't in Central Park, on the streets, slip into churches on a Tuesday afternoon or something, and just sit there. Emerson went on to say later, and later in life, I was surprised to read that he felt shamed out of his declamations against the church by the beauty of the Anglican liturgy. It was interesting to me that even Emerson, far removed from that traditional kind of worship, could see the beauty in it. This, of course, did not mean that Emerson rejected all his transcendentalist thought and became an Orthodox Christian again, but he was always open. He was a big believer that you should not worry about contradicting yourself, because you should always be thinking. And if what you think today contradicts what you said yesterday, so be it. That's a good thing. It shows that you're open and you're on a journey, ongoing, that you're not fixed in any particular, affixed to any particular idea. So, ultimately, and one of Emerson's biographers, Robert Richardson, has a nice phrase. He said, Emerson believed that everybody should follow, quote, the curve of his own faith. I like that phrase a lot. It's something that I think everybody believes in his or her heart, but many people's experiences with religion, unfortunately, seem at odds with that, right? So they abandon religion altogether. Many of my friends have. But we need, you know, we need community as well. It's in our nature. Community of some kind. For Emerson and his friends, it was essentially the intellectual salon. He would have, if you ever go to Concord, by the way, you can visit Emerson's house and sit in his parlor and see where this intellectual fireworks occurred. So he recognized that they needed community, even though he had abandoned the idea of church as we know it. But the important thing is we find community wherever we can. Ideally, we find community with everyone, find a common point if we can, even if we disagree, as many of my friends on Facebook often do with me. But what we're talking about, in other words, is faith. Whether we do it, we find it in communion with other people or in solitude in the woods. Faith is a problematic word, is it not? Certainly it is for a lot of people who again, have had bad experiences with religion. They hear the word faith, and it's like, vampire, you know. and I think the reason for that is a lot of people believe that faith equals certainty. But to my mind, and I think Emerson would agree, he suggests this if he doesn't say it outright, faith and doubt exist in constant tension with one another. It's human nature to doubt. It's a good thing to doubt because, again, it shows we're always questioning. Exists in tension. Now, tension is another word, right, that has a negative connotation. But musically, right, if you think about tension, the tension of a string on a piano or a guitar, you need tension to make music. If the string is slack, you won't make music. So if you think about that tension between faith and doubt in within us, there you have the music of our soul, or the possibility to make music of the soul. So, and then with that music then, presumably the soul opens up like these flowers. But we continue to have doubt. In that tension, then, I find comfort in those words of Emerson's. It is a luxury to draw the breath of life. It's a very, also a very Zen idea, to be fully in the moment without regretting the past or worrying about the future. Just be open to the moment. Luxury to draw the breath of life. And this reminded me just yesterday of another line from the great Stephen Hawking, who may be an atheist, but is, to my mind, spiritual in his own way. And Stephen Hawking said, "Where there is life, there is hope." Thank you.
Let's take those words of wisdom into our own heart as we go into our time of meditation. I invite you to get comfortable in your seat. Oh, let's just take a deep breath in and then release. One more time, deep breath in and let it go. As we pay attention to our breath, we come to this now moment. This now moment that holds all that has been up to this point and all that will be from here forward. We allow ourselves to settle a little bit more deeply into our seats and just feel the cares of the past or any concerns about the future fall away. Truly, in this now moment, we come home to who we most deeply are. We come home to the presence of God within us. I invite you to allow yourself to just relax into that presence. Come to the still place at the center of your being and rest there. As we allow ourselves to make this connection with Spirit, we feel our glorious oneness. We feel this beautiful sense of peace, deep, abiding peace. We allow ourselves now to go a little bit more deeply into that place of oneness and connection and love and peace, and commune with the God of our understanding in the silence. We give thanks for this refulgent, resplendent life on this summer day. We give thanks for the wisdom of the ages passed down to us through Jesus, through other spiritual masters, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, all those who've planted seeds of consciousness that now are taking root in us, in our beautiful unity movement, and growing forth to bring new hope and new love and new joy into our world. For the blessing of being part of the unfolding evolution of human consciousness, and to be blessed by these words of wisdom, and our hearts gently tugged forward into new possibilities, we're so grateful. Thank you, God. So it is. Amen.